taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were every day American.
Hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach a rising generation to be free. I am glad you could join me. Today, I'm taking a look into a series of articles that really beg the question, are we all created equal? Specifically, is it right for the government to have, let's say, special protections under the law? What has brought this about? Well, there have been several articles involving the concept of qualified immunity for law enforcement, and there have been several bills recently that talk about qualified immunity. So if we're going to talk about qualified, let's talk, what is qualified immunity? Well, the Three Legal Dictionary says that in the United States, qualified immunity is a legal principle that grants government officials performing discretionary functions immunity from civil lawsuits unless the plaintiff shows that the official violated the clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. And, you know, I kind of understand, I think, the rationale why this was put in place. And as you can imagine, people tend to sue governments. You know, we've become a very litigious society, so it's not really a surprise that people will sue over anything. And if you're a law enforcement officer and you're worried that, or any government official, and you're worried that any action you take could lead to a lawsuit, and of course, you're not paying it individually, but you know, if you're employed by the government and you incur enough lawsuits and it costs them enough money, there's reason to believe you might, well, let's say, not be desired, not wanted to serve in that position anymore. So they wanted to set up this process by which there was some immunity, some basic assumption that you couldn't sue a government official unless you had good cause. Now, there are several cases that brought about this qualified immunity. I don't believe is actually a law. As I understand it, it came about by court precedent. You know, again, putting the opinions of the court originally ahead of the actual law. And in 1967, a case named Pearson versus Ray, the Supreme Court justified this need for qualified immunity, arguing that, quote, a policeman's lot is not so unhappy that he must choose between being charged with dereliction of duty if he does not arrest when he had probable cause and being punished with damages if he does. And that kind of makes sense. I understand the logic of the situation, right? If a police officer, let's say a police officer sees a person looting, Minneapolis, Portland, you know, places where this has never happened before. So he sees somebody looting and he arrests them because he has probable cause that they've committed a crime, right? They're walking out of the Target or the Verizon store with an armful of stuff. Well, if he believes that he might be sued for damages for doing that, well, now he's in this, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Does he arrest the person and risk being sued, or does he not arrest the person and risk being fired for dereliction of duty? So I can see the reason why. Then in, was it 19, I guess it was in the case of, the Bivens versus six unknown named agents. The Supreme Court said, okay, a plaintiff can sue for damages when state officials violate his constitutional rights or other federal rights. This is 14 U.S.C. 1983, and it's used basically when you see people suing in federal court on rights infringements, it's under 14 U.S.C. 1983. But I believe the standard that the court uses actually comes from a 1982 case, Harlow versus Fitzgerald. You see, prior to Harlow, as I understand it, The court had a simple test, right? The official being charged had to believe in good faith that their conduct was lawful, and the conduct was objectively reasonable. Now, reasonable is not very objective, but the idea being that, you know, okay, yes, it's a reasonable belief that what they were doing was legal. But they started running into problems. See, how do you understand? How do you testify? How do you provide evidence of the state of mind of the officer, of the government official? Was it a good faith belief, or, you know, are they just saying that to get out of trouble? So apparently in Harlow, and again, I'm not a lawyer. This is stuff that I've done, read in some research. The Supreme Court set the current rule, which basically says government officials performing discretionary functions generally are shielded from liability for civil damages insofar as their conduct does not violate the clearly established statutory constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. Now, again, we live in the real world. I look at this and say, okay, I'm concerned. I'm concerned when there are protections for government officials that are not afforded to citizens. That places a government official above the citizen. That is an inversion of the power structure that was created by our founding fathers. So I think the standard should be simple. It shouldn't simply be government officials. I believe everyone should be shielded from suit unless they clearly violate someone's rights. And, you know, the person charging the prosecution should show beyond a reasonable doubt that the person either knew better or any reasonable person would deal with that. And the problem being, if we grant that to government and not to citizens, well, now an action that you do, which can get you sued, a government agent does, and they get away scot-free. That's a problem. But the problem goes beyond that because, again, we're not dealing with law. In other words, we're not dealing with a legislature, the representatives of the people and the representatives of the state sitting down and writing out the situations under which a government official or any individual can or cannot be sued. We have courts making it up pretty much as they go along, which leads to some pretty heinous situations where, courts suddenly say, well, you know, there's no reason why the government official should have believed that that was violating the law, violating the Constitution. And there's some pretty heinous examples of it. In a recent one, a federal judge in New Hampshire was looking at a lawsuit from the ACLU against Customs and Border Patrol, CBP. Quoting from it, it is unconstitutional for Border Patrol to use interior checkpoints nearly 100 miles from the border as a ruse to unlawfully search and seize people for the purpose of general crime control. Yet this is exactly what Border Patrol is doing with checkpoints in northern New England. The idea that, you know, again, Border Patrol, the idea is that should be on the border. How far into the interior of the country is border doing checkpoints? These obviously aren't entry points. And it's unconstitutional to think that a checkpoint inside of the border, not a border crossing, but an arbitrary checkpoint that is suddenly a reasonable search, that they have no probable cause, they have no basis for a warrant, but they want to search you. That is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But here we have a judge, Landia McCafferty, I believe is the name, looking at this and saying, well, you know, we can't simply dismiss the case because the government doesn't have proof that they're not going to do any more checkpoints. And they actually compared this to DUI checkpoints, which, by the way, are unconstitutional. Again, an officer needs probable cause to search you for any reason at any time. But it was interesting because the government fairly was concerned that, if we actually held federal agents accountable, we might have to disclose information that would impact national security. quoting, if the judiciary were to recognize a Bivens action, by the way, Bivens actions is the case that they use to say, yes, we can actually sue a government official. So if they recognize a Bivens actions against CBP officers in this context, damages actions and their attendant disruptive inquiries may proliferate. Because recognizing a Bivens action in this context would create a tangible risk of disclosing matters of national security, as well as unwarranted judicial intrusion to the area in which the judiciary lacks comparative constitutional authority and competence. Okay, in English, we're concerned that we're breaking the law, but we don't want to be held accountable for breaking the law because, well, that might be a national security interest because it's Border Patrol. Well, then stop breaking the law. We have a federal judge that's more worried about the potential possible floodgate of lawsuits than actually holding federal officers accountable because the Bivens actions is the case for qualified immunity. And this, by the way, is not the only one. In a case from last year, U.S. District Court Judge Carlton W. Reeves wrote, quote, the Constitution says everyone is entitled to equal protection of the law, even at the hands of law enforcement. Over the decades, however, judges have invented a legal doctrine to protect law enforcement officers from having to face any consequences for wrongdoing. The doctrine is called qualified immunity. In real life, it acts like absolute immunity. Sounds good. But then going on a little later, he writes, this court is required to apply the law as stated by the Supreme Court. Under that law, the officer who transformed a short traffic stop into an almost two-hour life-altering ordeal is entitled to qualified immunity. Wait a second. I thought he just said that qualified immunity was unconstitutional. Now, I wish to remind Judge Reeves he did not swear an oath to the Supreme Court of the United States. His oath of office that he swore affirmed to support the Constitution of the United States. But again, we have a court-invented doctrine that is being used in some cases to let law enforcement get away with breaking the law, with depriving you of your rights. So what's to be done? Well, interestingly enough, I've found bills from Illinois and Minnesota and that are attempting to nullify qualified immunity. Nullification, that's a scary word, Paul. We're not supposed to use that word, but it's true. It is the proper use of power. So a Representative Tarver out of Chicago, Illinois, submitted House Bill 1727 on February 11th, and it's designed to create a cause of action in state courts to sue peace officers who subject or cause the subjected, cause to be subjected, including the failing to intervene, any other person to be deprivation of individual rights arising under the Illinois Constitution. So what's the process? Well, typically, if someone violates one of your rights, again, you sue under 42.19 USC 1983. You sue in federal courts, but again, the federal courts have come up with this mythical qualified immunity defense, and they are not holding these officers accountable. So, this legislation, if it were to become law, would basically say, okay, you can't be sued in federal court. But if you violate the Constitution of Illinois, you can be sued in state court. Now, if you read many of the protections in the Bill of Rights in the federal Constitution are mirrored in the state Constitution. So many of the things, in fact, I can get a whole First Amendment discussion here, but if you violate a person's right under the federal law, you're also violating under state law, under the state constitution as well. This would give the citizens of Illinois the ability to sue someone who has violated the rights of citizens of Illinois or anyone in Illinois, even if the federal government is falling down on their job, if the federal judiciary is putting up a shield to protect them. Now, I'm sure there are some people out there going, but wait a second, isn't federal law supreme? It wouldn't, you know, if it's not okay for the feds to do it, doesn't mean the states can't do it either. The answer is no. the Constitution of the United States is supreme. The actions of the courts in violation of the Constitution are technically void. Just research the Supreme Court case, Marbury versus Madison, or read Federalist Papers 78. The idea that your rights can be superseded by the opinion of judges is laughable. And the idea that the federal government's rule over the states is equally laughable. Remember, the states created the federal government. We, the people, through our states, created a constitution which created the federal government. The federal government does not exist until the Constitution was ratified by the states. It is a creation of the states. Therefore, it is subject to the states. And the Constitution, the compact that is the Constitution, the states are the party to the contract. So they're the only one that have the authority to modify the compact. Now, Illinois is not the only state that's doing this. There's also a bill came out of committee just last week in Minnesota, from the Minnesota House, that does basically the same thing. It says, okay, if the federal government's not going to do their job, then we are going to protect our citizens, those who reside in our state, by actually applying the law. And apparently the bills in both Illinois and Minnesota are very similar to laws that have been passed already in Colorado and New Mexico. But it reinforces this idea of we need to make sure our protections are local. Rather than going to the federal government for everything, look at what's happened. The citizens of Colorado, New Mexico, Illinois, and Minnesota have said the federal government's not doing their job. We are going to step in. And that's important, one, because you have more influence over your state representative. You have more impact in the voting with your state representative. I mean, it's easier even to get a meeting with a state representative. Have you ever tried getting a meeting with your federal representative, your member of U.S. Congress? It's near impossible. So this is the proper use of nullification. This is the state saying, several states saying, no, Supreme Court, federal courts, you are wrong. What you're doing is unconstitutional. Therefore, we are going to start by protecting the rights of the people within our state, because that is the first and primary purpose of government. It is to protect the rights of the people, right? Right from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these rights, these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to protect these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. All of that is there. So, yeah, it'd be very interesting. Check with your state. Find out, does your state have a qualified immunity statute? Not simply what the courts say, a statute, a law written by your legislature, gone through the legislative process. Find out what it is. And if you don't have one that protects the rights of you and your fellow citizens of your state, well, write and meet and call your representative and start putting one together. If you want examples, well, there you go. You can go to the Illinois bill. You can go to the Minnesota bill, HF 1101. They are very close. You can find the bills, the laws in Colorado and New Hampshire. Let's learn from our fellow citizens, our fellow states, and let's actually apply the Constitution as it's written, rather than letting some oligarchs in black robes on benches trash the Constitution because they think they know better. Now, it's not simply government officials and qualified immunity where we see that we are not all treated equal. If you've been following the news at all, or even this program, you remember that when Georgia passed a law to make it easier to vote but harder to cheat in that state, there were a lot of people that were all bent out of shape. Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, you know, had a big stink, and probably the most well-known was Major League Baseball. They actually, I don't know if they did pull or just threatened to pull the All-Star game. In fact, I think they did pull. They pulled the All-Star game from Atlanta and sent it to Colorado because, well, I'm not sure why, because the reasons they gave didn't match the actual language of the law. So I've argued that and discussed that previously. But here's the interesting twist. See, on April 2nd, Republican Representative Jeff Duncan started drafting a bill that would remove federal antitrust exemptions from Major League Baseball. Now, here's what you got to understand. And again, my point isn't about antitrust laws. My point isn't even about baseball or other monopolies. My point is the unequal application of power. You see, right now there are people in Congress that want to break up, and by the way, a lot of Republicans in Congress that want to break up Facebook, Google, and Twitter because they see them as a monopoly and thereby a violation of federal antitrust laws. Okay, federal government has no authority to establish these antitrust laws. All they can do is regulate commerce between the states and with foreign nations. They have, if a company is so good at what they do that they beat all their competition in the marketplace, then the company's doing a good job. And when they start abusing that, it's all the more incentive for other people to come in and provide a better service. But notice, here's what we have. We have certain businesses that are under threat of federal intervention because those in the federal government think of them as a monopoly. They haven't proven they're a monopoly. They're just making, they use a lot of words, but this is what's happening. Yet we have this one organization, and I'm sure there are more. You have Major League Baseball. Well, they get an exemption from the monopoly. So you may turn around and say, well, anybody can create a baseball league, but apparently Major League Baseball has certain protections that would make it very difficult. And where do those protections come from? Oh, they come from the federal government. I thought we were all supposed to be treated equal before the law. I thought all men were created equal. Apparently, in the words of Orwell's Animal House, I guess just some of us are created more equal than others. I look at this and see, my issue is not that they're getting rid of that they want to pull the antitrust protections. It's why the heck did they have the antitrust protections in the first place? Why is the federal government picking people to get special access, picking corporations to get special access, special privileges not afforded to others? Put in a common vernacular, picking winners and losers. Why are they allowed to do that? Why are we allowing our representatives in Congress to give certain people special protections under the law that aren't afforded to the rest of us? Why are we not up in arms for them not holding the courts accountable for doing exactly the same thing? Because they do it themselves. They've created their own sort of qualified immunity for Major League Baseball. And now the only time they seem to want to use that is when they can use it to bully Major League Baseball because they don't like what Major League Baseball is doing. Notice it's been the Democrats that have been decrying and maligning and defaming the Georgia election law, but it's a Republican that wants to go after Major League Baseball's antitrust. Now, do you know why I say a pox on both their houses? This isn't a question of right. This is a question of political maneuvering. These special immunities have been given for political reasons, and they are taken away for political reasons. And that is one of the reasons why I say we never trust the federal government with anything. Any power we give them will one day be used against us. It's just the nature of the beast. And it's the type of thing that I find quite dangerous. I don't know why the American people seem so willing to elect people to pick winners and losers. Now, if you like this, I wanted to let you know that all of my shows typically go on podcasts about a day or two after the broadcast. If you hear something here that you like and you want to catch up with it, check the webpage, find out more. It'll come out on podcast in a couple days. You can also listen to them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeart, basically anywhere where you get your podcasts. So please subscribe. And if you would, please give me a rating on the Apple Podcasts. It's helpful if you rate the show. It gets more people to see it in their searches. It tells people that you think this is worth coming to. And if you want to find out more about what we're doing, head over to constitutionstudy.com. You can find out more about the articles I write, the work that we're doing, and this idea of educating ourselves because the federal government isn't. So we'll pick up with more of this right after the break.
Well, my fellow Americans, how did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list. And they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference. Five incredible years and we're just getting started. Well, they say time flies when you're having fun. Well, it also flies by when you're on a mission of love. Love of country, that is. Well, our goal is to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. You can listen in on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. AmericaOutloud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've joined the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I am glad you could join me. We've been talking about how we're created unequally, or at least that's the way we're treated by many of our governments. We start out talking about the idea of qualified immunity and antitrust exemptions. Second half of the show, I want to talk a bit about one of the things that really aggravates me, I mean, makes me just want to scream. And it's this idea of civil asset forfeiture. Now, let's start with a little bit of background. Back in the 1980s, government really started what they called the war on drugs. They looked at drugs as evil and terrible, and they wanted a way to go after them, especially the drug cartels that were not only bringing so much of the drugs in, but the crime related around the illegal drug trade. And they came up with this idea of forfeiture. The idea that, okay, if you're a drug dealer and you use a boat or a car or a plane in the bringing drugs into the United States, well, then if you're convicted, you should lose that. Not okay. I certainly we could have a debate on whether or not that is considered a cruel and unusual punishment. But let's just set that aside for a second. That's not the focus I want to talk about. The idea that you could forfeit your possessions on conviction of a crime. Let's not get into the details. I would say it's not too bad, right? It's not too bad. But you see, here's what's changed. That was criminal forfeiture. The idea that if you commit a crime, you could forfeit your property that was involved with a crime or purchased with proceeds from those crimes is criminal forfeiture. But see, there's a problem. You see, when we move from criminal forfeiture to civil forfeiture, there's a major change. See, in civil forfeiture, assets are seized based on a suspicion of wrongdoing. There's not even a charge required, much less conviction. But the mere suspicion of wrongdoing is enough for law enforcement to seize your assets. Now, that could be as simple as it has happened, you know, people driving across the country, they're moving from one place to another, they have a large amount of cash that they have taken out of their old bank to move, and, well, they get pulled over for speeding, and if the officer thinks, well, that could have been, that money could have been, be the proceeds of a crime, they confiscate it. In fact, there was a case in New York of the state of New York versus some amount, it's like $12,000. It's this, you know, I have this belief that there are certain things you have to be really well educated to be that stupid. Now, I believe there's three parts to what we're understanding. There is ignorance. I can understand not knowing something. And you pair ignorance with naivete and you get foolishness. That's what we hear from a lot of politicians, right? They're simply regurgitating what they've heard, regardless of whether or not it has any basis in fact, because they certainly haven't bothered to check. But it really seems to take a lot of schooling to believe that your right to be secure in your person's papers, houses, and effects disappears if some government official suspects that it might have been suspiciously acquired. There may have been some suspicion of wrong. No innocent until proven guilty. No day in court. See, civil asset forfeiture, as it's commonly used, is theft. Pure up, plain, government authorized, government encouraged, and government incented theft. You say, government incented? Yeah, guess what? Many of these laws when the assets are forfeited, eventually a percentage goes back to the department that confiscated it. So there you are. Some lieutenant, some captain in law enforcement, and you're looking at your budget going, wow, yo. And one of your officers or one of your deputies pulls somebody over with $100,000 in cash and confiscates it. And a few months later, you get $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 for your budget. Easy money. But that's theft. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's a violation of the Fifth Amendment. When the states do, it's a violation of the 14th Amendment because it's depriving people of their property without due process of law. And the courts have let it happen. Why? Oh, well, we want to deter criminal activity. So you're going to punish innocent people to help deter criminal activity. I'm pretty sure that's a dereliction of duty. Oh, well, we want to enhance police cooperation. Yeah, we want all these law enforcement organizations working with each other to infringe on your rights. That's not what they're there for. They're there to protect your rights. And as I've already mentioned, it's revenue for law enforcement. So this is just, this is criminal. This is not merely unconstitutional. This isn't a gray area. This is flat out theft. This is criminal. Of course, these people never seem to be charged with crimes. No one ever files charges under 18 U.S.C. 242, where it's a federal crime to deprive someone of a right protected by the Constitution under color of law. So once again, we return to the proper concept of nullification. One of the purposes of the state is to protect us from the federal government. So we have in March of this year, a Missouri House committee passed a bill that would close a loophole in the civil asset forfeiture law. See, Missouri looked at this dumpster fire, this felonious mess of civil asset forfeiture and said, you know what? We are going to put some more restrictions around it. We're going to put some limitations. We're going to protect some of the people's rights. But then I guess some law enforcement agencies found a loophole. You said, okay, the state won't steal the assets. We'll let the federal government do it. And the federal government will give a kickback to the police agency. So there was a loophole that allowed state and local police agencies to get around state civil asset forfeiture laws by making it a federal case and let the federal courts prosecute it and then take their kickback. It's a kickback. It's a bribe. This is a bribe. This is, you give us a case where we can illegally steal money and we'll give you money back. That is a bribe, flat out, plain and simple. So House Bill 750 was filed. And again, now it's out of committee. I'm curious, if you live in Missouri, talk to your representatives, push this forward. Do you want your rights protected or not? Oh, sure. You know, we need it for law enforcement. No, you don't. This isn't law enforcement. This is theft. Well, we need it to fight the war on crime. No, you don't. This is your own crime. So again, I encourage the people of Missouri, get in touch with your representatives. Let them know that you want that you expect them. You don't want them. You expect, you demand that they follow the Constitution, that they remove this loophole. And in fact, I want to see them pass a law that makes federal acts of civil asset forfeiture within their state a crime, punishable by jail time. And I want those federal agents that are stealing money from the people, citizens, and residents of Missouri, I want them to do jail time because they are committing crime. They are committing theft. And they're doing it under color of law, which just makes it worse. Now, in the Northeast, apparently both Rhode Island and Massachusetts in April are dealing with bills to reform the state's civil asset forfeiture laws. In Rhode Island, they're looking to require a crime to be committed in order for the assets to be seized, or at least to be forfeit. So not only would you have to be charged with a crime, you'd have to have a criminal conviction before a state agency could move forward with asset forfeiture proceedings. I like this, right? I like this for a couple of reasons. Because let's face it, let's say you're an innocent person, or let's say you're a guilty person, and you have a right to your day in court, you have your right to counsel, and you have the right to hire your own counsel. But how do you do that if the government has seized all your assets with which to pay counsel? So thank you, Rhode Island. I like this. Let's continue. And again, if you live in Rhode Island, it's Senate Bill 732. Find out more, because not only apparently does it require a criminal conviction, it also closes some of the loopholes that would allow Rhode Island law enforcement to allow federal programs for civil asset forfeiture. So this would basically opt Rhode Island out of these federal programs for kickbacks for state and federal civil asset forfeiture laws. This is good. We should see more. Now in Massachusetts, it's Senate Bill 965. And again, it's going to reform some of the civil asset forfeiture laws. For example, one of the things it would do is any profits from civil asset forfeiture would go into the state's general fund rather than the law enforcement's funds. So it would remove some of the incentive, right? Because if you're a county sheriff or you're a city police department and the money doesn't go to you, it goes to the state, well, you don't have what they call policing for profit. There's less of incentive for law enforcement to seize assets because they think they're going to get a share of them. Because one of the things about civil asset forfeiture laws is you're assumed guilty until proven innocent. In other words, the government comes in and seizes your assets, and you have to prove that they were not ill-gotten gains before maybe they release them to you. So this is an extremely dangerous, onerous, disgusting, tyrannical, despotic law, and it's being used in almost all the 50 states. Now, the bill would also remove some of the incentives for police departments to participate in the federal programs, Massachusetts police departments to be involved in federal programs. But you know what it doesn't do? It doesn't put the conviction requirement in place. So even though what's going on in Massachusetts makes things better, it is still a vile theft, corruption of law that says we're going to steal from you and you're going to have to prove to us that you deserve it back. And up in arms, this is, I mean, they might as well be showing up with black hats and masks covering their faces because they're robbing the train. And whether it's done at the federal level, the state level, the city or county level, this is theft pure and simple. It's disgusting. And you know what else I want? I want all the citizens, if you have been involved in civil asset forfeiture, or you know someone that's been involved in civil asset forfeiture, I want you to get the number of your local FBI office. I want you to call them up and file a complaint, ask them to investigate as a violation of 18 U.S. Code Section 242. What is 18 U.S.C. Section 242? Well, Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 242, is titled The Deprivation of Rights Under Color of Law. So listen to this. Whoever, under color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, willfully subjects any person, any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution of the United States or laws of the United States, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. So think of it this way. When law enforcement officers or any government official deprives you of your property without due process of law, that is a violation of the Fifth Amendment. If it's a state agency or state or state or county, it is also a violation of the 14th Amendment. So these are rights protected by the Constitution of the United States. Therefore, under color of law, depriving you of them should get you fined or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. Oh, yeah. And if bodily injury results from the acts committed in violation of this section, or if such acts include the use, attempted use, or threatened use of a dangerous weapon, explosive, or fire, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. So if that officer, when they come to, say, confiscate your car or confiscate your home or take your cash or your any property, and you say, no, where is your warrant? Where is your proof? Where's your problem? You need proof. You simply cannot deprive me of that. If they threaten to take you into custody, if you are injured during that, or if they even threaten to use a weapon, if they threaten to pull a gun, if they threaten to tase you or baton you or pepper spray you, they could be fined and imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. And I want you to think of those people. They have been physically abused. There's even charges in, I think it was the Lavoie Finnegan case, of him being killed by federal agents. The details behind it, I don't want to say because I don't have all the details. It's absolutely horrendous what I've heard. And I've heard it from people that were involved. But since I don't have the details in front of me, I don't want to give you the details. But we have situations where people were killed from this. If death results from acts committed in violation of this section, or if such acts include kidnapping or attempting to kidnap, aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to commit aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to kill, shall be fined on this title or imprisoned for any term of years or for the life or both. Or maybe sentenced to death. There aren't a lot of things where the federal death penalty is allowed. But if someone under color of law is depriving you of your rights and you are, and someone in your family is killed in that act, that's serious enough for the death penalty, according to Congress, according to the representatives of the people in the states. So here's what I want. I want everyone in the United States that either has or knows someone who has been a subject of the theft called civil asset forfeiture. Your assets have been seized. There's been no warrant. There's been no due process. There's been no charge or conviction. I want all of you to pick up the phone, call your local FBI office, and file a complaint on the individuals. We're not filing a complaint against the city, the state, the county. It's the individuals who did this. And this is important. And this is why I go all the way back to qualified immunity. Remember qualified immunity? We started out the program with qualified immunity. Even under the Harlow test, or it's called the Bivens test, I believe, government officials performing discretionary functions generally are shielded from liability for civil damages insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. It doesn't take a law degree to recognize that taking someone's assets without even charging them for a crime, much less convicting them of a crime, is a violation of the Constitution. It's also a violation of federal law. It's also a violation of most state laws. It's theft. So let's get rid of this nonsense qualified immunity, or at least let's go back to a more reasonable standard. Let's go back to this idea that, yes, we will protect from civil suit a person that is not acting unreasonably. But the idea that the states and federal government are protecting and encouraging theft on this scale. One, I don't think most American people realize it. The idea that government, with no proof, no evidence, merely a supposition by an official, can take anything of yours they want. They can take your house. They can take your car. They can seize your bank account. They can seize your money. They can literally destroy you. And again, no due process, no criminal charge, much less a criminal conviction. So if you live in Missouri or Rhode Island, contact your representatives. Push this bill through. There must be a conviction before assets can be forfeit, before the asset forfeiture process can begin. That is minimum. Also, push to make it a state crime for federal officials to steal from the citizens or residents of your state. A criminal charge. Have your state attorney generals pushing the FBI to not only investigate, but U.S. attorneys to prosecute civil asset forfeiture. If it violates the rights of the American people, how many American citizens must be destroyed by the state before we'll say it's too much? How many people have to lose their homes, their businesses, their livelihoods before we'll stand up and say, you know what, that's probably not a good idea? I understand the wish to go after criminals. So while I want to have that as a discussion another day, the idea of seizing assets of someone who's been convicted of a crime to seizing assets that were gains from that crime, I can see some logic behind that. But seizing the assets of innocent people, because until they have been found guilty by a jury of their peers in a public trial, they are innocent. And when you take money from innocent people, that is theft. That is disgusting. That any sheriff that allows this to happen should be run out of the county on rails. The idea that you would have a sheriff that would allow this to happen should disqualify them from law enforcement, period. The same for a police chief, the same for anyone in the state police command. Any government agent that steals from the innocent American people is a criminal and should be punished. They should be fined, and yes, they should go to jail. And just, "I was following orders" is not good enough. It didn't work for the Nazis. It shouldn't work for the American government either. But you see, this is what we deal with in America today. This is what happens when the American people sit back and let governments become tyrants, become dictators. This is what happens when we sit back and simply say, "Well, what can I do?" This is our fault. I say it over and over and over again. This is our fault because we keep letting this happen. The question is, what are the American people going to do about it? Abraham Lincoln said, the people are the rightful masters of both Congresses and courts, not to overthrow the Constitution, but to overthrow the men who pervert it. Civil asset forfeiture is a most heinous perversion of the Constitution. If we are the rightful masters of Congress, if we are the rightful masters of our state legislatures, if we are the rightful masters of our courts, then it is our job to overthrow the men and women who are perverting the Constitution. I don't care what party they're in. I don't care what good they've done. I don't care what flowery words they can use to justify it. If they are stealing from the American people, they are perverting the Constitution, they are perverting the means of justice, they must be overthrown, and we must restore the Constitution to its rightful place as the supreme law of the land. Now, another president, a bit older than Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, said, "I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power." And I believe that's absolutely right. See, I believe civil asset forfeiture happens and other atrocities happen mainly because the American people either don't know what's happening or don't understand the details. They haven't been involved in the details. So if Jefferson is right, if we are the ultimate power in society, if we are the rulers, if we are the ones that form governments and set their boundaries, then it is up to us to exercise them to make sure that our will, our laws, our consent is followed. Now, I know most people that I encounter, they don't feel prepared. They don't know that they understand enough. They look for lawyers and judges, which I've just shown are just as guilty of stealing your rights as any petty tyrant. So what are we to do? See, if we don't think the American people are wise enough to exercise that type of power, if we believe somehow giving them a government paycheck makes them smart enough to actually do this, well, besides the fact that that very idea is foolish, the answer is not to take the power away from the American people. The answer is to educate them. If we want to correct the abuses of constitutional power, we start by educating the people. And that's what we're trying to do here. We do it here on the program, the Constitution Study, where people help people read and study and understand the Constitution and how to apply it so that we know what our rights are and we're prepared to defend and assert them. head to constitutionstudy.com. That's where I do that as well. I do articles, videos, more long form work, more detailed work. I work with people. I do events. I do schooling events. I do training events where I help people learn how to read and study the Constitution so that they can be educated and they can correct the abuses of powers that are being done to them. And I've got another site called Constitution Scholars with an S, constitutionscholars.com. That is where you can join with others. You can find others that are interested in becoming educated and being prepared to deal with the abuses of power. It's absolutely free. You do have to register, but it's absolutely free. You get access to a library of books and videos. You get access to different state groups and other groups where you can discuss and debate. You can find others that are interested in the Constitution, in learning and studying, and informing their discretion. You can also find discussion groups, right? So you can join the group for your state, see what's going on in that state, and start discussing what are you going to do? What's right? What's wrong? How do we deal with this? Read and study the Constitution. Teach the rising generation to be free. And all of that is out there to help you be better educated so that you can properly correct the abuses of power that are going on every day in this country. Rather than looking for some messiah, rather than looking for a president or a political party that's going to fix this problem for us, it's time we, the American people, stood up and decided to fix it for ourselves. To start locally with our counties and our cities and make a difference. And the way to start is through education. So I hope you'll check those sites out. I hope you'll learn more. And I hope we can discuss whatever comes in the future right here on the Constitution Center.